Morning and welcome to the continuing education course on stereotactic cranial radiosurgery and radiotherapy. My name is Dave Shepard. I'm from the Swedish Cancer Institute in Seattle, and I'll be co-moderating the session with Tim Solberg from the University of Nebraska. Tim will start off the session talking about LINAC radiosurgery, and then I will talk about Gamma Knife and CyberKnife. So let me introduce Tim. Thanks.
Thanks, David. David and I have done similar courses for a number of years, either at AAPM and ASTRO. And, just when we think that we know everything and everybody knows everything, I find out that's definitely not the case. So as David said, I'm going to talk about LINAC radiosurgery, and he'll talk about Gamma Knife and CyberKnife. But maybe I can just poll the audience real quickly. I think we still think of radiosurgery as a new modality and a new technique, but does anyone in the audience know when the first radiosurgery procedure was performed? 70s, 60s, 1951, so it's been around a long time. I'm going to share some of my, I've been doing this for about 40 years myself. I'm going to share some of that 40-year experience with you, and we're going to talk about QA. There's no way we can cover all of this in an hour. And we'll be around after the symposium if you'd like to. Oh, I'm going to start my timer. If I don't start the timer, I'll just go on and on. If you want to come up and ask some questions. So I'm going to try to give you my list of things I think are important for you to look for with a little bit of a historical perspective as I do this, because with radiosurgery in particular, there's so many important things you can learn from what's been done previously. Here's a little bit of my outline. I'll talk about some mechanical aspects, LINAC frames, beam data acquisition and commissioning of the treatment planning system, end-to-end evaluations, which I think are really important, both dosimetric and targeting evaluations, a little bit about imaging fusion, and frameless radiosurgery. So I mentioned that it's been around for a while. LINAC radiosurgery was first performed in 1983, and for better or worse, mostly worse, I guess, there's no standard set of LINAC radiosurgery procedures. There's no standard devices. They're all over the map. And some of the devices you see here have progressed through history. But I think it's one of the things that makes LINAC radiosurgery and QA a little bit challenging and one of the things that our field needs to address. And at the same time, there's no kind of standard equipment. There's no standard techniques either. Historically, it was done using circular collimators and rotating the gantry, and Irvin Podkersek kind of enhanced that by rotating the gantry and the couch at the same time. Micro-multi-leaf collimators came into fashion. Then we could do conformal radiosurgery. You're probably familiar with the NOMOS system, which did rotational IMRT, and other techniques like dynamic arc, where you move the leaves simultaneously while moving the gantry. But fundamentally, this test was published on in 1989. Fundamentally, this is one of the most important things you need to know about and be proficient at and know how to characterize if you're doing LINAC radiosurgery. You guys are familiar with star shots for couch, collimator, gantry. Well, we don't do that in radiosurgery. For one, it's not accurate enough. So Wendell Lutz came up with this test. That's why it's called the Winston-Lutz test, where we put a radio-opaque ball where we think the isocenter is. The place we think the isocenter is always going to be governed by our lasers. So at some point in this process, the lasers have to be set properly. All LINAC radiosurgery is governed by your lasers, although I'll talk about frameless radiosurgery in a little bit. So put a radio-opaque ball where you think the isocenter is. Take a bunch of shots and evaluate those shots. Here's a little movie that shows how that's done. So rotate your gantry, rotate your couch, take a number of shots of that ball, and let's move on. And then analyze those. So this is a very old film from, say, 1992, and hopefully you can see the projection of the ball within the projection of the circular field. And it's not all perfect, but what kind of results should you expect these days with good LINACs and a good LINAC radiosurgery system and good lasers, etc.? Well, if you look at the average displacement of the ball inside the field, you should expect something on the order of about a half a millimeter. Modern LINAC can do this. In fact, several of the vendors will spec a LINAC that has a half a millimeter mechanical isocenter for you, and this is how it's evaluated. Does it always stay that way? No, it sure doesn't. And another good question is, what frequency should you do this at? We do this every day. We used to do this before every radius surgery patient. If you have 5, 10, 15, 20 patients a day, that gets a little bit cumbersome, but you need to do it every day that you're doing a radius surgery procedure. There are a variety of reasons for that. And there's some things that can change on a day-to-day basis. So you need to do it daily. And what do you do when it starts to look like this over time? It will definitely drift over time, and your precision becomes worse and worse. And then you bring in your vendor, as we did. You can see how fresh these films are. This was on the 10th of July or the 16th? In any event, bring in the vendor, reshim the gantry or reshim the couch in this case, and reshoot and get your precision back. Here's a blow-up of a couple of those. And usually you find these are bad at your extreme angles, your extreme gantry angles or your extreme couch angles in our case. So there you see the before. Obviously, you can see that's way off. It's about a millimeter or a millimeter and a half, and after. So fundamental test for evaluating your mechanical precision on the LINAC radius surgery system. What about frames? Again, here's a great historical paper that people have forgotten about, but this was done in 1995 by the group at Vanderbilt, and they looked at a variety of different radius surgery frames where they would put a device like this inside the frame, image it, get the stereotactic coordinates off the images, and then compare those coordinates to the supposed true coordinates as defined by this stand. And what they saw is vary greatly as a function of CT slice thickness. That's no surprise. But even as you went to very small slices, you're looking at about 1.5 to at most 2 millimeters of uncertainty that you're going to get just from the process of putting a frame on a patient and doing the imaging procedure. So you need to always keep this in mind, what kind of uncertainty you have for what steps in the process. And in the early 90s, we came out with relocatable frames. There are several of them that you see here, from the Gil Thomas Cosman to masks. Here's one that goes in the ears and on the nose. And that allowed us to do fractionated radius surgery for the first time. So that's good biologically in some sites, but it gave us additional challenges, and that is, how do we know that that device goes on the same way every fraction? So if you're going to do fractionated radius surgery, you need to have some mechanism for evaluating that, the day-to-day reproducibility. And here's one of the methods. You could use port films. You could use a variety of things. This is called a depth helmet, and Hanakui published on that, again, in 1994. And if you use this measuring device and you compare that to the measurements at the time of CT, you can get pretty good accuracy or precision. But, of course, he says the frame is not appropriate for single fraction because you can easily have some large outliers. So you need to have some way of assuring that the frame's on the same way every day. Okay, that's just frames. There are so many parts to the process. There's the frame, there's imaging, there's treatment planning, there's positioning back in the room. You have your mechanical sources of uncertainty. You have your dosimetric sources of uncertainty. There are so many times when I use end-to-end tests to look at something, either in terms of localization and targeting or in terms of dosimetry. So the fundamental question is, when you put a frame on a patient and do a scan and define a coordinate system based on that localizer on the frame and define an isocenter within that coordinate system that you then transfer back to the LINAC in terms of some positioning device that you set up to your lasers, how do you know that that point in your CT scan that you want to hit is accurately reflected in the patient in the treatment room? So I'll show you some ways that you can go about doing that. You can use some phantoms. So I love hidden target tests, not just for radius surgery, but for a lot of different things, whether you're getting a Calypso system or any of these new technologies. Hidden target tests really tell you a lot, end-to-end hidden target tests. So you can embed a sphere inside a phantom and then process it just like you would a patient. Put it in a stereotactic frame, do an imaging procedure, get your stereotactic coordinates, create a treatment plan, take it into the treatment room and set it up. So for everything's done exactly like we would do a patient. And then I can do a Winston-Lutz test on that hidden target, and I can assess how well can I hit that hidden target. So this is a great way to test several parts of the process together. And I'll come back to that in a little bit. What else do we have to worry about? Well, if you have an MLC system, you want to know, are your leaves shaping properly? So here's another nice test. I've got an old phantom with some objects in it. Again, I can scan it, and I can contour an object, for example. I can, and the treatment planning system says, oh, yeah, I can automatically shape the leaves to that object, and I can put an isocenter somewhere. But is that really reflected in reality? So through my record and verify system, I send all of that to the machine. I set that phantom up again just like I would a patient. And I can look at the projection of the leaves on the object. I can look inside the object and see, do the lasers actually intersect at that point inside the phantom? I think we're all used to commissioning treatment planning systems. We're all used to commissioning LINACs. We know we have a really significant responsibility when we do those things, when we do an absolute calibration. I think when we get to some specialized procedures, either because we're unfamiliar with those procedures or for whatever reason, we expect a little bit more from the vendor, or we assume a little bit more from the vendor. That is, when you get something, there's kind of an implied stamp of approval on this thing that it's working okay. So here's a very minor example that that's not always the case, and you shouldn't always trust a vendor. Again, you don't trust a vendor to commission your treatment planning system or your LINAC, and don't trust them for radius surgery either. It's just a little news clipping, a very recent one. This particular manufacturer, and I'm not picking on them, made a localizer box that had an error in the coordinates in the localizer box. It made a 1.25 millimeter difference. Probably not significant, so it's not a huge cause for alarm. I think it could have been picked up with the proper commissioning procedures, and it wasn't. The point I want to make on this slide is don't trust your vendor. Don't shirk your responsibility when it comes to radius surgery. You have an even greater responsibility with radius surgery. And the other thing is in general, vendors and the community have an obligation to let us know about these kind of things. This vendor did. Other vendors don't. So we really need to make a huge effort to educate our vendors and our colleagues when we find problems. Let's let everybody know what the problem was, how it came about, and what we can do about it so they don't get repeated. I think a challenging thing for everybody is doing beam data measurements for radius surgery. And even though the calculation algorithm is very simple, the direct measurements are pretty difficult. You should know when you get a treatment planning system, what does your planning system do and what doesn't it do? Historically, they haven't done corrections for tissue and homogeneities or contour surface curvature. Know whether your system does that or not. If it has some features that allow you to account for that, then know if they work or not. I think the biggest challenge people face is in beam data measurement. You'll find collimators or MLC shapes down to 4, 5, 6 millimeters. And there's a story about a poor physicist in France who did some commissioning measurements, and he used a 0.6 cc Farmer chamber for his small fields. It's not that he was incompetent. He just wasn't used to thinking this way. And of course, when you do output factors on a 4 millimeter beam with a 0.6 cc Farmer chamber, you're not going to have accurate output factors. There's some other challenges. So how do you get a reference dosimeter in when you have a 4-millimeter beam? So you can take your LINAC apart a little bit. So what you see up here is we actually tried to put the reference in way up high in the LINAC so we could do some scanning. But you need to think about these things, how you're actually gonna do this in practice. What should you use to measure the beam data? Well, I put some devices up here that I'll recommend and elaborate on a little bit. You know, you need depth of data, off-axis ratios, output factors, and of course you need to calibrate your machine. And these are the devices that I would recommend, and I'm gonna actually say, that diodes should be used for all of this with one or two caveats. And here are the devices that you could use. So that poor French physicist had used this instead of a Farmer chamber. He would have been in much better shape. But even this is a little bit big for a 4-millimeter beam. Actually, most things are a little big for a 4-millimeter beam. So we like diodes, and these days, this is the standard diode to use, the stereotactic diode. Has about a 1-millimeter cross-sectional area and about a 60-micron thickness. So you can use that for your depth dose measurements. You can set it on its side and do your scanning with it. Gives you very nice resolution for scanning. What about output factors? So there's a warning for using diodes for output factors, and that is they have enough energy dependence that the ratios between large fields and small fields aren't accurately preserved. So what do? You know you need the diode for very small field measurements. So use it for small field, overlap for kind of intermediate size fields, and then go back for larger fields, larger meaning 4 centimeters or larger, and use your ionization chamber. And you should see agreement in here, and then down here you'll have accurately reflected output factors. The beam data looks just like any other beam data. So as a function of field size, you're going to find the distal slope decreasing a little bit as I go from small field to large field. You may or may not be aware that your Dmax is going to shift a little bit. Could shift by 2, 3, 4 millimeters. So as your field sizes get smaller, your Dmax is going to shift a little bit towards the surface. Your profiles look just like regular profiles, although they're a little bit sharper. In a minute, I'll show you some of the penumbra for that. And the same for multi-leaf collimators. And we'll measure all the way down to 6 millimeters by 6 millimeters. But your depth dose curves look just like any other depth dose curves. Why am I saying that? You'd say, well, of course, they should look like depth dose curves. In a minute, I'm going to show you some of the depth dose curves that I've observed in my time in this field. Penumbra. These beams are pretty sharp, so fortunately we have diodes with small volumes that can accurately characterize our profiles. But for circular collimators, 1.5 to 2 millimeters for 80 to 20% fall off. That's a pretty sharp field. For your micro multi-leaf collimators, a little bit bigger, but not terrible, 2.5 to 3 millimeters. And these are the kind of values you should expect to see in your system. If you've got a radio surgery system and you see 6 or 7 millimeters of penumbra, either it's not a very good radio surgery system or something's wrong, but you can bet if you publish on this or present on it, the neurosurgeons in particular are going to be critical of beams like that. The output factor, as I alluded to, falls off very sharply with field size. Nobody would use 25 MV for radio surgery, I hope, but you can see at that high energy how sharply the output falls off when you get down to 5 or 6 millimeters. And of course the implication of that, even at 6 millimeters, is your treatment times can be fairly long. They can go up by a factor, your monitor units can go up by as much as a factor of 2 if you're using very small collimators. Okay, so there they are again. This is actual data from our clinic. The output factor is a function of field size. And I did make handouts that should be on the web, so if any of this is useful for you, you can go back and refer to those handouts. Same for the multi-leaf collimator. Okay, so that seems simple enough. Why are people having so many problems? Maybe you're not aware of it, but I'm aware of it. So we looked at 40 identical machines, and we looked at depth doses, scatter output factors, etc., and we compared those, and I just want to share with you some of the observations that we found in doing that. So here's an institution which has a depth dose curve, which may or may not look okay here, but definitely the build-up region doesn't look right. So you should immediately recognize that there's something not quite right in the build-up region. Here are two institutions whose data we do trust. And again, it's a normal-looking kind of depth dose curve. Normal-looking buildup region, normal-looking distal part. Here's another example. This is actually a good set of data, and this is a funny set of data. No buildup region at all, so that doesn't happen in radiosurgery. And then some kind of funny effects down here. And people were using this clinically. So if I can drive home any point in this section of the talk, you know, you guys have seen depth dose curves. You know what they should look like. They're not different for radiosurgery. Here's another example, some funny waviness here, funny buildup region. And this is actually what we observed when I moved to University of Nebraska a few years ago, that they had this green curve, which had a discontinuity for a reason no one knows, at about 10 centimeters depth. And so as you went deeper, say 15, you're actually introducing about a 10% underdose. Okay, so they don't do that. Output factors, I'll admit, are very challenging to measure, especially for small field sizes. So in the 40 institutions that we looked at, here's a subset of them, and you can see there's about a 45% difference here in a 6x6 millimeter MLC field for the output factors. And look at this institution down here. I'm not sure where these came from, but this is about 0.05, and that's grossly wrong. Hopefully it doesn't impact the calculations or the outcomes too much. Commission your treatment planning system just like you would any other treatment planning system. So calculate a series of point doses, go in, measure those doses, do the calculated point doses, agree with your measurements. Look at the distribution. So and do that for realistic examples. So if you're using circular arcs or dynamic arcs or MLC, do those kind of calculations. So here's a piece of film, and we did a circular arc delivery. The color wash is film. The lines are from the calculation. And the green out here show areas of disagreement as demonstrated by a gamma calculation. And so you see this funny streaking thing at a regular pattern. And that's an artifact in the calculation that was only doing the calculation every 10 degrees. So if you change that to every 2 degrees, now the color wash and the lines line up very well. You can get this kind of agreement in the radiosurgery system, even with small fields. If you're using MLC or IMRT, do the same thing. You know, you'll want to put some film in this orientation and check your measurements and calculation. You want to put some film in this orientation. Again, this happens to be a 7-field IMRT, and check the integrity of your dose distribution. Use an appropriate phantom. We need, you guys all know that stereotactic body radiation therapy is the wave of the future. And if you don't, you certainly will within a year or two. So we do radiosurgery for spine in a single fraction, very carefully, obviously. And a lot of the beams go through lung. So we want to know, is that calculation doing okay when the beams go through lung? So when you map this patient's plan onto a phantom, maybe use an appropriate phantom where the beams go through lung and check your distributions. Always, of course, check your absolute dosimetry over and over and over again for every configuration you might use. And this is from my colleague at UCLA, Nizja Aghazarian. This is the distribution of the difference between measurement and calculation of the absolute dose in the first 160 IMRT patients that were treated on a radiosurgery machine. And some things you only learn after experience, so you don't really know what your distribution of uncertainties or errors are until you treat a few patients, do some dosimetry, and evaluate those. And so this is pretty good. And now we have a baseline to evaluate things in the future. Just like you do end-to-end targeting tests, you want to do end-to-end dosimetry tests. So put a phantom in a frame, put some dosimeters in there, scan it, plan it, set it up in the room, irradiate it, and directly verify the dose just like you would a patient. And this includes then many sources of uncertainty from frame to imaging to setup, etc. You can use Bang gels if you want. We do this a couple of times. It's very labor-intensive. There's a number of ways you can do these end-to-end tests. What about second MU checks? Some of you have RadCalc, these other things. And some of those things out there will support radiosurgery and some of them won't. So you're going to come up with some way to do your second MU checks. We use an Excel spreadsheet for circular collimators, for micro-MLC. I think most of the commercial second MU software systems will do that. But what about dynamic arc, where the MLC is moving continuously? Most of them won't support that. So we have Excel spreadsheets for all of those things. Let me change gears briefly to talk about some imaging aspects. For cranial radius surgery, you need CT for its geometric accuracy. You need MR for tumor visualization and anatomy visualization. You need them both. I'm going to convince you in a minute that you shouldn't do it with MR alone. This is now a little bit of a dated document. Oops, report number 54 came out in 1995, and just a quote from here, MR contains distortions which impede correlation with CT at the level required for radiosurgery. I'm going to show you that in a minute, but MR has some spatial distortion, and you can try to do good MR QA and characterize your MR systems, or you can do image fusion, which is what I recommend. This came from a Gamma Knife Center in 2001, and what you're looking at is the calculated dose in the lines superimposed on a bang gel image of the delivered dose, and you see a little bit of a shift. And in fact, this isn't a random shift, it's a systematic shift. And these authors went on to explain why that happens in the frequency encoding direction due to susceptibility artifacts in that are induced by the localizer. So if you change the direction of the frequency encoding direction, you can see that if it's left to right, you get a shift this way, and it's anterior posterior, you get a shift this way. And you can, as I said, you can get your MR physicists to do good QA and minimize this, but there's always the potential that this creeps in. So what should you do? What you should do is image fusion. Image fusion works beautifully for cranial localization. Just a couple of movies showing how that works. And I'll say now, and I'll repeat in a minute, that you obviously shouldn't trust image fusion for extracranial applications. So let's move through here a little bit. Yeah. So this is a young patient where we wanted to treat a target in the spine, and we pushed the magic autofusion button, and we watched the brain fuse beautifully, and hopefully you can see that in the audience okay. That the brain fused beautifully, but at the C2, C3 level where we wanted to treat, the fusion wasn't good. So don't assume image fusion is going to work outside the brain. Again, the report number 54 from 1995, a little bit dated now because a lot of these sources of uncertainties have improved. But if you want one reference to go back to your radiation oncologists and neurosurgeons and try to convince them why you want to put 2-millimeter margin on that acoustic neuroma or metastasis, this is the one to go back to and show them that all of these uncertainties added in quadrature are on the order of a couple of millimeters. So always keep that in mind. Going to change gears briefly and talk about frameless radiosurgery because frameless is now possible and becoming very popular. And just a couple of slides to tell you what the basis is for frameless radiosurgery. There's a discipline called photogrammetry, which means use two or more two-dimensional images, projections, etc. And from that, you can reconstruct a three-dimensional position very accurately. And this is used in biomechanics, as you see on this guy. If you have a Tiger Woods golf game, Tiger Woods at some point went into a room, put these things on his body, and that's how they captured his swing. You can do it on horses, and you can do it on elephants. And my colleague at University of Nebraska does it on pigs. So stereophotogrammetry is a very well-understood discipline. In 1995, the folks in Heidelberg looked at using that for radiotherapy and radiosurgery. So they put the reflective markers on a bite block, and they assessed this whole process, not the clinical part, but just the characteristics of the system. You can find these markers in the bite block very accurately with high spatial and temporal resolution. And Frank Bova then commercialized this, so another paper you can refer to. And we looked at putting this on the skin of patients and using this for body radiosurgery, and what we found was that you can't trust any skin marks for body radiosurgery. If you want to do body radiosurgery, you have to have image guidance. So I'll say that now, and I'll say that again. You've got to have image guidance for body radiosurgery. This kind of system doesn't work. Stereotactic body frames for body radiosurgery. They're great immobilization devices. I would never treat a patient for body radiosurgery without an immobilization device. But at the same time, I wouldn't count on these devices as providing my localization accuracy. They're good for immobilization. If you want to do body radiosurgery, you need image guidance. There's a lot of image guidance systems out there now, fortunately, and this will add one more level of complexity for you to test if you're going to do body radiosurgery. I'm going to just show you an end-to-end test that we've done to look at image guidance techniques for radiosurgery. So this is our system at University of Nebraska. We can take a stereo set of x-rays. This is exactly like stereo photogrammetry instead of using x-rays rather than infrared cameras and markers. So take a stereo pair of x-rays, and I'll run this movie maybe, and then fuse the x-rays that you took of the patient in the assumed treatment position with your DRRs, and then that will tell you where you need to make the final shifts in order for them to be positioned accurately. Okay, you're not going to just use that and take those shifts as truth. You're going to test it, and this looks very familiar because it is. How are you going to test it? Put a hidden target in a phantom, put it in a frame, scan it, plan it, and then transfer that to the treatment room. Here's the conventional way. This is where we would treat the patient if we didn't have image guidance. But we have image guidance. Take the x-rays, fuse with the DRRs, reposition, and then take that hidden target image. And this then tells you how close is your image-guided system or your frameless system to your conventional. And in a phantom, you can get within a millimeter, plus or minus half a millimeter. So image guidance, at least in this implementation, works very nicely. How about in patients? Well, we studied this in fixed-frame patients and in fractionated patients. And here's what we saw. In fixed-frame patients, if you compared where we would set them up with lasers to where image guidance tells us to set them up, we're within about a millimeter, same as the phantom. So based on this, I'm pretty confident that I don't need the fixed frame anymore for targeting localization, but it helps in immobilization, of course. What about the mask? Now you see a much bigger spread, 2.5 millimeters plus or minus 1.5, and of course this just reflects the fact you can't get the patient in the mask the same way each day. So here's single fraction, here's fractionated. And the take-home message here is, with frameless radiosurgery, you don't have to have a frame anymore. And if you're doing fractionation, it will definitely improve the day-to-day reproducibility. Do this in extracranial targets as well. So there's a hidden target. We can go through the whole process. We never just trust any one thing alone, so we don't trust the x-ray system alone. But we have skin marks. We have other references, always to double and triple check that we're at least in the ballpark. And I'll just show you a couple of quick extracranial applications before I turn it over to David. So here's a spine case, and this will show you a fusion of spine. And anywhere you have good bony anatomy, this will work great. Not just bony anatomy, but stationary bony anatomy. So for the spine, these systems work beautifully. You see the fusion going on, and you see the shifts that we needed to make. You know, it's exactly what you would expect. Skin marks get you within about half a centimeter in every direction. These image guidance system will get you the rest of the way, hopefully to within a millimeter in every direction. Need to move to the lung. Lung's a little more challenging. You don't have good bony anatomy. You don't have good stationary bony anatomy. And so the ideal thing would be to use implanted markers. I'll just show you this movie. Unfortunately, this patient had some hardware from his operation, and we were at least able, without implanted markers, to use that and confirm that we're pretty close. But for lung and liver, the challenges are significant without bony anatomy and with anatomy that moves with respiration. So I'm going to turn it over to David. This is in the handouts you can get from the web. There's great guidelines available, some from AAPM, a couple from American College of Radiology, and there is a task group now that should have a report out by early 2008 on stereotactic body radiation therapy. But look at these guidelines, look at these documents, refer to what people have done in the past. As I said, the Winston-Lutz test, that was developed in 1989. I still rely on that for so many things. So there's a lot of things that you will use and need to use that have been done before. So we'll be around afterwards. I want to turn it over quickly to David so he can continue on talking about Gamma Knife and CyberKnife QA. Thanks very much.